Okay, sorry that a couple of us were late. We were being entertained on a modest proposal that we'll talk about more. And let's begin this work session. I believe Commissioner Novick will be here shortly. So welcome, everyone. Do you have to call the roll for this? Not to call the roll for this. It's a work session. So I think with that, I'm going to turn it over to Susan and Paul. And we're going to start working our way through the issues from a very good public hearing and a lot of interesting dilemmas about how do we do this and how far do we go.
So Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and with me here is my cohort, Paul Scarlett. This has been a very collaborative effort between the two bureaus, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and Development Services. And so you'll remember that last month we had a lot of public interest about the issue of short-term rentals at the testimony at the public hearing. It was as part of the recap discussion, the Regulatory Improvement Code Amendment Project. You went on to adopt all of the code changes in that package except for this one, and you had suggested that we come back and have a discussion of these items. So at that hearing, there was a lot of conversation kind of on I wouldn't say both sides of the issues, I'd kind of say throughout all of the issues. People who were very supportive of short-term rentals, that they had been able to keep their homes because they had gotten additional rent from being able to rent out a room in their homes, that they had rented to their neighbors' parents, and all sorts of different stories like that. You also heard from people who were very worried about the changing character of their neighborhood and about the potential for noise or other nuisance, and they wanted to make sure that you understood what they felt some of the impacts were. So you should have in your binders some of the issues that we discussed at the Planning and Sustainability Commission. I wanted to, as part of that, I've listed out what the Planning and Sustainability Commission's kind of recommendation for each issue was, so that you can hear exactly what they thought were the pros and cons for each one. And my hope is that from this work session, that we can write up any additional amendments, bring them back on July 2nd, and then you can vote on July 9th. And I'll turn it over to Paul for anything else.
Thanks, Susan. Paul Scarlett, Director for Bureau of Development Services. Thanks for having us here again. Very excited about the majority of the Recap 6 items being approved and moving forward. This particular portion of it, the short-term rental, as was witnessed at last hearing, has created a lot of attention and controversy. Our main goal, of course, is to try and provide clarity and have this aspect of the zoning code be very streamlined and workable. Since the last hearing, Susan and I and staff from BDS and BPS have met and had further discussion on different issues. And trying to provide some clarification and I guess suggestions for moving forward. At BDS, our mission is to promote safety, livability, and economic vitality. This couldn't be any further from the truth in terms of how this element as an emerging economy for the city of Portland, as you know, is already in place. And so the regulations that we're forming is aimed at assisting this economy, but ensuring that those who are occupying these spaces, at safety is at utmost importance, and that we want to make sure that people can get in and out of these houses safely, and that the regulations are being maintained. And so we are from that position still very focused on seeing how this can work best, both for the Bureau, the city, and the community. And so we, of course, continue to be part of this process and look forward to working this out. In fact, we're probably more involved with the process because once the code is written, then BDS will be the one administering and enforcing the regulations as is adopted. So thanks, and look forward to today's work session.
Great. Okay, so Sandra, are you going to walk us through the items in numerical order? Is that the plan?
Just put We've had significant technology upgrade in City Hall, so nothing works.
Excellent. So I just want to make sure that everyone has a copy of the document, the latest version that we have. It's dated June, and the orange one too. Okay. So it's dated June 20th at the top. Everyone does that. Here you go. I have extra copies. And there's copies over there for members of the public should they need them and want to follow along. Thank you. Okay. Before I start, so I'm with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and I've been working on this issue for quite some time. We also have Planning and Sustainability Commissioner Chris Smith available and in the audience. Terry Williams is here with his Revenue Bureau. If we have tax questions, and of course my colleague Mike Liefeld, who's been my go-to person in BDS about all the inspections and all of that. So there were 15 questions that came up at the end of the last hearing. I think many of the commissioners had some questions. We wrote those down. There have been subsequent emails from your offices of questions to go over today. So they are divided into 15 questions, and we categorize them into three categories. The first category is single dwelling issues. The second one is multi-dwelling issues, and the final one is other issues, in other words, miscellaneous stuff. So just starting from the very beginning, the first page we have, it's all about inspections. And we thought it would be helpful to really divide these issues into who should do the initial inspection, who should do the renewal inspections, because that has been part of the conversation, and what is being inspected. The first item is the initial inspections. The Planning and Sustainability Commission recommended that the that BDS, inspectors at BDS, conduct the initial inspection. Commissioner Fritz, and with a friendly amendment from Commissioner Novick, have an amendment on the table to amend the code to have the initial inspection be by BDS, and then every 2 years the renewal be self-inspection, and then after 10 years another full inspection. So that's what's on the table currently, and members of the public had an opportunity to testify to that amendment. So our response to that is really, I think what's before the council is, should it be BDS? Option two is, should it be, and this was a suggestion that came out of one of the offices, should it be the Oregon Certified Home Inspector, in other words, a third-party inspector that can do the inspection? Option three is, do we give the applicant a choice whether to go through BDS, and it's included in the permit fee of $180, or go through an Oregon certified inspector, or should they always self-certify? So those are kind of a comprehensive list of options that we heard from the various offices.
Is there currently a situation where someone other than a BDS employee performs an inspection?
Not that I'm aware of.
So we'd be kind of crossing into new territory.
So that would be new. And second, what is an Oregon certified home inspector? Certified by whom? And are there any legal liability issues that change by having someone other than BDS do the inspection?
We've been in contact with the state as well as labor relations, and Mike Liefeld can get into more details. Just quick correction or revision to my response to your question, Commissioner Fish. We do have third-party inspectors for more technical things along associated with large developments such as glazing and so forth, what do they call special inspectors and so forth. But the building code and housing code are all BDS and zoning BDS inspectors.
And does it change any of the legal issues that are concerned to us?
Yes, in this particular case, we had a meeting with the state last Thursday, and there are concerns around folks who are not certified by the state to conduct building code in verification and inspection. And that's a conversation that the state said we can continue, but their sort of initial preliminary reaction is that would be of concern.
The Oregon Certified Home Inspectors are regulated by the Construction Contractor Board. They have to be licensed through the CCB, and there are rules about which type of inspections those inspectors can complete. Preliminary analysis from the CCB indicated that they did not believe that the Oregon Certified Home Inspectors would qualify to conduct these types of inspections.
the follow-up question would be, if BDS did the initial inspection, and there are some 1,500 units that are currently listed on the website just for Airbnb, is that feasible for BDS to handle the volume that we're talking about?
Realistically, it wouldn't be feasible if everybody was to come rushing in at the same time. We don't believe that's going to occur. It may be more of a phase. And we've explored and discussed different options to accommodate, should this happen. We believe we can structure a system to conduct the inspections and verification. And we have, based on being an operating bureau and have revenues available to us to that we could do, whether it's a variety of different ways of adding staff to address this issue up front. And then once it levels out, we should be okay.
So in other words, certified inspectors, the Oregon Home certified inspectors, both the state and the contractors, construction contractors board are saying those inspectors are not qualified to do these home inspections in their interpretations and beliefs.
Preliminary interpretation from the CCB indicates that they don't believe their licensed inspectors would be allowed under the terms of that license to complete this type of inspection. We haven't received anything formal in writing, but that
state,
was the conversation.
State concurs with that, is that?
Yeah, the state. They're both the state, different arms of the state. The Bureau Building Codes Division regulates building code inspection, verification, plan review processes, and they're the ones that have to comply with the certification requirements for a building inspector, which a home inspector doesn't carry those certification, hence the disconnect.
We also reviewed some of the standards and limitations for the large organizations for home inspectors, the associations, and they seem to mirror the same limitations for performing types of inspections that the CCB covers in their literature. So it seems like they're aligned on that issue.
I want to point out I have Mitch Nichols, our inspections manager, and at some point we may call him up too. He's an expert in this area of work as well.
Me about the effective date and the because if you're doing all of a sudden 1,500 requests come in, I realize not everyone is going to just do that, but in theory you could have a big surge of applicants. So did we talk about effective date? Did we talk about giving people a grace period in which they could apply for the or seek the inspection? In other words, are we trying to meter the activity to what you can do by any of those means?
I'm not recalling the specifics, but we certainly can explore a variety of options, everything from phase into grace periods. We talked about it a little bit, or maybe.
There have been some questions about that, and what we would expect is after the effective date, that would be the start where that would be the signal that people are to register, make the application. If they make the application, get it in the queue, and we are having this surge, we would work with them to give them an ETA about when we think we can complete that inspection, let them know that we won't be pursuing enforcement for not having a complete permit because they're in the queue and they're doing everything that we've asked them to do at that point. So we communicate that, you know, their case is in abeyance, essentially, that they're in the queue and they're doing everything right.
All right, so other questions or suggestions about this one? I want to try to keep us moving because you've got 15, I think, of these topics for us to work through, but I think that helped clarify that one at least.
Well, not to belabor, but I did mention that we contacted labor relations, and so internal city employee contract and so forth may be of an issue as well, since inspectors, DCTU inspectors, typically do this work, and if they didn't, then may border on contract and elements, which we'd have to deal with.
Yeah, okay, good point. Okay. Other council questions or concerns about this one? I want to again.
Well, Commissioner Novak and I have discussed perhaps having an amendment at the next hearing to make it reinspection every 6 years rather than every 10 years.
That is correct. After the due deliberation, we thought that, you know, a lot can happen in the property in 10 years.
Okay. All right, good. Thank you.
So
go ahead, Susan.
So the next issue is about renewal inspections. Same conversation, but who should do the inspection at the renewals? self-certification, or should BDS be coming into and conducting the inspection every 2 years?
I guess I'd have the same question. What kinds of self-certification do we currently offer customers of BDS?
I don't know if we currently offer any self-certifications. We have tried it. We have done landscaping certification for commercial projects, and we've had mixed results with that, I would say, through auditing of really is a certification proving that the required landscaping was installed and maintained over the time of the project. We do conduct home occupation renewal inspections. I mean, it's much less than the initial inspection, but again, it is processing that paperwork, making sure the notification is complete and was done, and then, you know, contacting the operator to see if anything else has changed and perhaps going through their home as well.
My feeling was about this. I like the proposal for a six-year cycle and then recertification in between. Whereas I think that the Oregon Certified Home Inspectors idea, again, was a creative idea, and I liked it at one level. But again, between what we're hearing from the state and the concerns about our labor contracts, I think that one's probably cost benefits not there. But I think because the homeowner shares or perhaps owns much of the liability in this situation, I think a self-certification is a reasonable level of risk, you know, to my eye, for those intervening years in between a public inspection. That, come on, this is someone who's making part of their home available for short-term rentals. If there's a problem, they're going to own at least a very large portion, if not all, of that problem from an insurance standpoint. So it seems to me a reasonable case where we sort of share the quality control, if you will, between the city and the participating property owner. So it maybe is an unusual situation.
Mayor and Paul, could we do a blend where we did self-certification? We also made it clear in the disclosure that went to the property owner that we do spot inspections.
Yes, we could do a combination of that. Plus, we have a fairly robust complaint enforcement process. So should there be concerns, and some of the occupants of Airbnb, you know, they could contact the city if there are concerns. And so we could get to those concerns through our enforcement process. I concur with the mayor about the sort of two-year or recertification, and it would be tied to the original inspection and sort of verification, you know, whatever the mechanism we provide for approval. And so it wouldn't be outside of those bounds. And so I'm comfortable with that. The six-year reinspection by BDS inspectors is solid. And I was sharing with Commissioner Fritz that this actually ties in with some of our timelines for code cycles. They're three-year term or code cycles, and so this is two codes. And so that's consistent with some of the processes we already have in place for reactivation of old permits and so forth.
Would it be your intention to require a posting in every venue that notifies the prospective tenant of the obligation of the owner in terms of our code with something that says if you believe that the unit does not have a working this or that, you can call the fault, you can this is how you can make a complaint? Because the transient occupant is not going to know about that, and if you rely heavily on people bringing code enforcement issues as they arise, don't we have to affirmatively let the prospective tenant know that the city mandates the following things and that presumably the landlord has certified that these things are all functional?
I'm not sure about the tenants themselves, but certainly the landlord, the owner or landlord of the property would be informed of the code requirements and obligations are as to how that get passed on. We could deliberate that. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we might want to. I mean, I think it's an interesting point, Commissioner Fish, and we ought to think about it and figure out how we're going to implement it. It might not have to be in what we adopt for now. I have a bias on this issue, which is one: this is a new economy activity here, and people are doing this on the web. So a piece of paper on the back of the door is pretty old technology for what we're talking about. And then my bias is I worked for the hotel industry for years, and there's this old state law that says you've got to have all the Oregon hotel law on the back of, you know, every door in every hotel room, and I challenge any of us to claim to have actually read it. So I'm not sure how much good that does. You know, it's in theory a disclosure. In practice, it's just words on a page.
No, I always read those.
I would say
I set myself up for that.
As always, guess, Commissioner Fritz is the exception that proves the rule.
I guess the one distinction I would make, Mayor, is that if I'm staying at the Heathman, I'm going to make certain assumptions about their ability to follow the law and their reputation following them. If I'm staying at Susan Anderson's guest room, and she's making a few bucks in the summer, I hope that she's aware of that, but I'm not necessarily going to make the same assumption about her level of knowledge and expertise. That is the only difference.
This is very deja vu. We had a similar discussion at the PSC, and there came to a point where they were saying what we put in code should be at a sort of certain level versus what's sort of the practice. And we want to be careful about trying to write every word into the code. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't put this in, but to keep that in mind in terms of how far you're going to put each little bit into the code, I do, yeah. So I think we can look at that.
All right. So are we ready to move on to item number 3, which is what's being expected?
And Commissioner Saltzman's suggestion about adding carbon monoxide detectors, it looks like the Bureau thinks that's a good idea. Any need to discuss that any further? I think that one's a good idea that's in the mix.
So, Mayor, just one wraparound question for 1, 2, and 3. What? So if there's a violation of this rule, then what happens? What's the consequence?
You mean if they don't get an inspection?
Yeah. If either they don't get inspection or they submit a incomplete, or they don't self-certify, or they self-certify and provide erroneous information, what's the stick?
Certainly depends what we're looking for. If they don't get a permit and have come to city to get a permit, we wouldn't know about that. We're not out looking and exhausting all the different internet sites and sources to find that out. So if we do get a complaint and we verify that the house, the unit's being used for such activity and a permit is required, it wasn't obtained, we certainly would notify the property owner of this requirement. If when we do go and inspect and the room or rooms are not, it doesn't meet the building codes, then we notify them of the requirements, give them a certain period of time to comply with the requirements. If that's not done, then we could initiate enforcement actions up to and including penalties.
Well, so someone trips and falls in Pioneer Courthouse Square, the lawyer brings a lawsuit, names 100 parties, but starts with the city of Portland because they know there's a responsible party there. So why not simply require that Airbnb, as a condition of these licenses being issued, cannot put on their website any unit that they do not have verification has been inspected?
Well, part of the issue is that it's not just Airbnb. There's 50, you know, there's not 50, but there's a dozen right now, and there could be 50 different
ones. So make them liable.
And many of them do not, they're not the third-party contractor. They're merely a website, and you would contract directly with the other person.
But let's take the ones Airbnb collects a fee from the person that opens up a unit.
Right, but that's not the case for all of them.
I'm just thinking Airbnb.
Okay.
So why not? And they claim that there's 1,500 illegal units currently listed on their website. So as a condition of allowing them to continue to list illegal units on their website, why don't we make it just a modest requirement that they verify that people have the units been certified, inspected?
I'm not sure we get to regulate what they put on their website, yeah. But I like the suggestion of having the license number posted, so then we can educate shoppers that they want to go to the ones with the license number.
I think there's a fundamental difference in the zoning code that we regulate uses and not necessarily the operators. And so there's an aspect of being singled out in some cases, the city's been sued for that. So I think we have to be careful what we stipulate of a particular operator versus how the property is to be used and what are the regulations associated with use tied back to the zoning code's primary purpose.
You know, I get all that, but I'll go back to what Charlie said earlier, which is the world is changing and people craft legal relationships in order to relieve themselves of liability, and we get all that. That's why they have smart lawyers. We're talking about life safety issues. I wouldn't start with the premise that we quibble about this. I would start with the premise that we want to make sure that every unit has been inspected. And so what's the most effective way to do that? Why not somehow bring Airbnb into the mix? Now, they're going to say legally they're not because their lawyers say so and they've structured it in such a way and blah, blah, blah. Fair enough. But if our premise is we want to make sure that simply every unit is inspected, mm-hmm. I would start by saying, in what way does Airbnb as a responsible business partner want to make sure that their units are inspected? I assume that they want to be the leader in the industry saying every unit listed on our website has been inspected. I'm not saying we have to necessarily compel that.
Staff has had some of these discussions. My sense is that Airbnb and other providers of this service are interested in, one, us legalizing this so that their operators can be legal, two, having a threshold for legalization by those in terms of both cost and compliance requirements that's doable for most people. And I think we're there. I think with what we're working on in the core of this, we're there. And then three, there's got to be some kind of trial and hopefully not error, but trial and adaptation period in which, in terms of both public information and disclosure, we make the new system work. So I guess I don't have a sense that no one's lawyering up here in this discussion. Not that you were implying that, but I'm thinking we've probably got work to do at a administrative rule level beyond whatever we put in the zoning code. But let me let the staff who've actually had these discussions talk more about that.
Actually, Mayor, I can't resist throwing an idea out there, piggybacking on what Commissioner Fish said, which is we could, as the owner of Lion and Rose suggested, require that as Commissioner Fritz just mentioned, that in advertising you list the license number. And maybe one addition we could make to that while we're waiting for all the inspections to be done is you could require them to say, here's the license number, and either inspected or not yet inspected. So we take into account the fact that some people, we wouldn't be able to get all the inspections done immediately, but the customers would see that.
I think one of the concerns is that guests that come from all over the world to stay in Portland and stay in other cities and are using some of these platforms don't necessarily know what all of the local rules are. So if they go and they see that there's a unit available and there's no license number displayed, they wouldn't necessarily know that that was a requirement anyway. So that's one of the issues. Certainly, I think what we're delving into in some of these issues is, what's appropriate for land use regulation and zoning and use, as Paul was discussing, and what isn't. And maybe we are looking at having more admin rules or stipulating it in the ordinance and figuring out what the enforcement mechanism for all of these extra things would look like.
I think what you're hearing from just this conversation, which I think is helpful, is yes, we can go the traditional route of using enforcement, fines, administrative hearings, mm-hmm. but we're not. No one presumably is in disagreement that these units should have a operating smoke detector and an egress that's lawful and the three or four things we care about. So, and I'm sure Airbnb has every incentive to be known as the most responsible short-term rental company in America that makes sure that the units that you get are safe. People don't die in them. I mean, that's just, I would think that's actually not a bad tagline. So we haven't, only 10% of our customers, aren't able to use our services again because they die in an unsafe unit. But all I think we're suggesting is let's within the limits of what the law allows us to do, let's just think about ways of making his job as easy as possible. And it isn't so much for the customer to go on the website and see this stuff. It's for you guys to go on the website, see the 1,000 units that have licenses, see whether they're inspected or not, go through your database and just do a spot verification. Either are or they aren't.
So I think that's one of the things. I mean, we have a permitting process where it has the address and the permit number. So for us, it's very easy to tell, and it is for the public too, because they can go to Portland online and see if a permit is there. So I think from the neighbor's perspective, it's actually easier to go through our permitting system than to go through all of the various websites to see if they can find their neighbor who may or may not be renting out the house, and all they see is a picture of the bedroom with no address. It's much easier to go to portlandmaps.com, type in your neighbor's address where you suspect this is happening, and see if there's a short-term rental permit or not. So just a piece of information.
Still curious about what's the consequence of not adhering to this requirement. So that you get a notice. You get a notice of
a code violation.
You get a notice of code violation. A chance to be.
A chance to go.
Is there a, have you developed a proposed fee schedule for this?
We already have fees in place that are applicable to all violation cases.
Just ballpark. What would it call? What would you ding someone?
For a single family, it was $280 something right now per month. And it doubles after 3 months. And we could go to a hearings office.
That seems to me a good ratio between what the cost of the permit is and what the cost of the noncompliance is. So that seems, that sounds good. Okay.
One other thing on this is that I think as you go through this, hopefully quickly, you'll come up with other issues like this that you're not sure whether it should go in the code or not. I think we're going to have at the counter, hopefully, sort of a sheet of here's how to be a great short-term rental owner. And we could include on there the kinds of information you need to have for the clients who are coming to your homes. And this would be one of the things that, you know, you post the number, you do these other things. But there's a whole list of other kinds of things that are, without having to put them into the code, help them to be the best sort of owners that they can be.
So the next three issues in the worksheet, number 4, 5, and 6, to me, we got a lot of sort of eye-opening, at least for me, testimony during the hearing about all the different flavors of how this service is provided and who's an operator and can you own the house next door. So I think a lot of us were struck by all the ways that people have already innovated in how they're doing this, and what I think you've tried to capture here in 4, 5, and 6 is those sets of questions about, okay, so what is a primary residence and who is an operator and what's the level of on-site management that we as a community would care about enough to require it in our zoning code? So, Sandra, why don't you take us through those? But that's my, again, I thought that was, I thought the hearing overall was great. We got a lot of great testimony, you know, on a variety of perspectives, but I learned a lot about how this is working out there.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. Yeah. So items 4, 5, and 6 are intricately related. And there was a lot of testimony. And I think when I was hearing the discussion, it seemed like there was a lot of confusion about these three issues, the primary residence, who can be the operator, the host on site. And then the term owner-occupied was used frequently. The Planning and Sustainability Commission had a discussion between owner-occupied and renter-occupied, and they came to the conclusion that there is no rational basis for differentiating between a renter and an owner. So what we want to talk about is the residence and not whether somebody is the owner or renter. So we didn't add that list to the issue, but I just wanted to clarify that. So for number 4, primary residence, this was the very beginnings and kind of the kernel, the crux of the proposal that came before you, which is that, of course, residentially zoned areas in Portland, the purpose of them is to provide land for housing. And so what does housing mean and how much of extra activity do we allow in houses? We looked through the code and we looked at multiple variations of business type things that are allowed in residential zones. Of course, institutions are allowed. They go through a big conditional use process. Home occupations was the most akin, and we to this activity. So we modeled our ordinance after that. So the PSC's recommendation is to allow for short-term rentals as accessory or secondary to the residential use that's taking place in the unit already. So that means that the individual or family who operate it lives in that dwelling unit. as their primary residence. They did not define what primary residence meant. We had a discussion about that, and we said it basically means that that's at least 6 months out of the year that you're living in that space. They had discussions about, does that mean you can leave for 6 months and rent it out on a nightly basis while you're gone? And the answer was yes, that could happen. San Francisco recently came out with a proposal, and that's option number two that we put before you. And they increased that 6 months to 9 months out of the year. And I want to clarify that San Francisco, they have a proposal on the table. They haven't gone to their commission hearings yet. They also coupled this with a maximum of 90 days that you can rent a year. We aren't stipulating a maximum number of days, so we're saying 365 days a year.
So let's take the example of the young woman who testified. I think she was from Overlook, and she said that this had been so successful she bought the house next door and was buying other properties. So in essence, she was building an inventory of rental housing and managing it as a business. Theoretically, she gets to declare one of those homes as her primary residence, right? So under this rule, she would not be able to rent out the other houses and other properties?
That's correct. Under this rule, we would consider those other houses, issue number 7, a dedicated vacation rental. They are not providing housing for permanent Portland residents, long-term residents, and they are a commercial establishment.
So let's take her, just go back to her for a second. She's got 3 homes. She's bought them in her name. They all have mortgages in her name. How do we actually know what is her primary residence? She's going to say that they're all her primary residences.
Yep. To be somewhat cynical, sorry, if it's 6 months, they probably could have 2 houses in 6-6. We might need to make it more than 6 months. Because this scenario actually, and sorry, we haven't had a discussion about this, but you raise a good question. Certainly, the standard look at it would be one of those houses. You have to declare one of those houses that's your primary units. The others are rental units. But if it's only 6 months, there's 12 months in a year, so then what do you do there? It's one of those little technicalities that we may have to address.
Is that why San Francisco's moved to 9 months?
I don't know, but...
San Francisco's situation is very different because they have almost entirely multi-dwelling. They have about 9,000 listings as of recently, my recollection is. They moved to, well, their new proposal is right now it's prohibited everywhere. And so they were just trying to create a definition for what would be acceptable, and what they're toying around with, one of the commissioners is proposing, is 9 months with a 90-day cap.
Yeah, so they haven't adopted their, this is just one of their ideas. And so we could say at least 6 months, that gets rid of the having more than one. The other item is that any of these places can be rented out for 30 days. If you rent your place out for more than 30 days, she could do what she was doing. She could have these other places and rent them out on a monthly basis. And you can do that now.
So the other example that I found compelling was the lady in law, Lads Edition, who was the operator on behalf of her mother who lives on the site within the ADU, and that seemed to me in the spirit of what's being proposed. So is there a way to allow that?
So that's issue number 5 on our sheet, which is who can a non-resident be the operator. The Planning Commission's recommendation defined the operator as the resident. In our discussion of that, we thought, well, of course family members or neighbors can come over and help their mother-in-law, but the operator and the application form shows that the resident is the person who's applying for the permit, is cognizant, and is in essence the operator, who's, you know, and whether their daughter or someone else is managing their website, that's fine. The question that came up in subsequent, some of the subsequent testimony by some of the property management groups was, okay, can you be a resident in your house and hire out all of the operation, the website management, the cleaning, the washing the sheets, the meeting people at the door with a key to the unit in the back? Is that okay? And so that's the question before you is, should they be able to designate anybody else to operate the short-term rental on your behalf?
Yeah, it seems to me that the important part is the residence being a primary resident for someone, and then whether they are running the website, their daughter's running the website, or some third party's running the website, I don't really care.
By allowing the designee, it seems to me like we could be spawning a whole other set of small business opportunities of people to do it and actually have a higher set of professional standards. Why not?
That was why we put it as another option there, because we think it's something that might be a good idea.
That's a legitimate option. I mean, you've got a global level here. I mean, the staff trying to do the commission that favors our residents, taking the commission to zoning code that's mostly about protecting existing uses of an existing district, not separating it from other work. Reasonable accommodation of what people are doing, but it's a one more step away from the traditional R5 or R7 single family neighborhood where only half is primary residential use and monthly rentals.
And I think maybe what makes it even more palatable here is that, again, if it's over 30 days stay, then you can have a company that comes mow the lawn, do all that stuff, and that's as a right. So I'm not sure there's a clear distinction between over and under 30 days. There's a rental house on my block where someone has a company come mow the lawn and maintain. I mean, that's, I'm not sure that has any impact on the character of my neighborhood.
So just to make sure that we keep going through this, so we have on for four, we have a choice of sort of what the proposal now is to say it's at least 6 months out of the year. Is that it's your primary residence? Or you could change it to some other number.
Does the 6 months... Doesn't that tie into state tax laws about being an Oregon resident in order to pay Oregon taxes as opposed to California or Arizona taxes?
We
you have to live in the state.
We should confirm that in terms of what that.
I think that is.
And maybe. Yeah. And maybe you rely on a driver's license to demonstrate that.
Right. So the idea, as far as operations was going, was that when you submit your application, you say, I am the resident, you submit your driver's license or another Oregon valid ID, and we would verify that that's the unit that you occupy.
Yeah, even though I'm interested if that ties into Oregon tax law, it does mean I necessarily am not open to the 9 month suggestion.
And I think the two, and one of the reasons all these issues are on one page is because they're all interrelated. And, you know, if you're you live at a house for 6 months, let's say you're only there for 6 months, and you get to also designate or hire a property management group that you're gone for 6 months, and people are coming to the site every night, you know, it's a short-term rental, so it's like one in every two nights, and you're absent during that time. They're interrelated on as far as how much accountability and on-site supervision you want to see.
I apologize for having had to jump out for a minute. I just wanted to throw in my two cents. I mean, I was inclined to like the San Francisco suggestion and to like the idea of limiting the number of days you could be renting your house while you're off-site, just because there's something that, I mean, it seems like there's a point at which you're no longer a person renting out a bedroom. You are running a little hotel. So putting some sidebars on that seemed reasonable to me. I mean, the dramatic way of saying it might be, if you're the one bringing the axe murder into the neighborhood, then you should be the first one to face the consequences. Now, maybe we can't make that an absolute rule, but I think some nod towards that rule is reasonable.
So we included that option as under issue number six, so host on site. So maybe we can, not the axe murder.
I don't want to muddy the waters here, mm-hmm. but I'm sitting here trying to figure out how on earth we could enforce this. I mean, we can put any number you want in there, but would someone explain to me how on earth we enforce this unless Paul sends someone who just sits on the front step of that neighbor's house and just monitors comings and goings? How on earth do we know whether it's 6 months, 9 months?
It seems that another option that the planning, when they had the same discussion, was A nuisance is still a nuisance. So if there's people coming in and out at all hours of the night and they're loud and they're causing all sorts of problems in your neighborhood, you still have a way to deal with that issue one way or another. And whether it's two nights or six nights or 90 days or, you know, that is sort of like a, you could have someone who's following all these rules but being really loud. And so what do you want to go back to is being able to enforce for nuisance to the neighborhood.
Okay.
Another piece of conversation we've had internally is that with this, of course, enforcement is very important, but we're also setting the public expectation. I think most Portlanders want to follow the rules. We just need to know what the rules are. And so that's one of the, you know, internal conversations we've had, is like all of us getting on the same page about how much is too much, what is the expectation.
So to get some clarity on the primary residence, I think we need to get direction about whether we want to change it from at least 6 months. And then on the next one, we want to talk about whether or not we can have a designee. And then maybe we do those two, and then we can talk about the next ones.
Yeah. The designee one is the easier one, right?
Yep.
Right.
I think there's a consensus. We're not allowed to deliberate, but I think there's a consensus that the designee is okay.
The other, the other case is... The PSC's recommendation is what's going to come forward, and you know, someone can amend that
and
if
I think
they want.
But. Dan has asked for some additional information about 6 or 9. I would just bring two amendments forward, 1-6, 1-9, and then
vote.
And just we'll get the tax law and maybe something from Terry about how we do our verification at the city. And is there something, is 6 months consistent with something else we use?
It will be difficult to, possibly difficult to verify and enforce, but it just feels like the 6 months create a scenario that we may not have previously anticipated of having two primary residents under technical definition. So if you want to sort of delineate it to one, then I think it's something other than at least 6 months. It's maybe more than 6 months.
Do you have the primary residence being the address on their checkbook?
It's not the checkbook or license, how long you claim that resident to be in that residence. So check.
Okay. Yeah, I've been trying to figure out how to come in here. Okay. With regards to primary residence. Primary residence doesn't necessarily have to do with the amount of time or anything like that. You can be gone from your primary residence for a year, and it's still your primary residence. It's where you intend to come back to. It's where the center of your life is. It is where your banking happens, where you vote, where you're registered to drive. Those are all the things that create primary residence. I could travel around in my RV for 18 months, but my primary residence is still in Portland because that's where I'm going to come back to when I'm done. And so I could be there for a day, I could be there not, I could be there 365 days. It's where I'm always going to come back to. It's the center of my life. And that's kind of primary residence.
But are you allowed to identify more than one primary residence?
No, you are not under tax law or general definitions. You can only have one primary residence.
And that's why in practice we found that linking it to a driver's license or an ID card, the process that the states include for going through that,
or where you vote.
It is sufficient, a credible exercise to establish that primary residency about where someone is indicating to the state that this is where I intend to come back to, or you can find me here.
Terry, if primary residence has the legal definition that you've just shared with us, then the qualifications about occupancy doesn't seem to me to go to the question of whether it's your primary residence. It goes to the question of whether we want someone who has claimed a primary resident to also be an occupant for a period of time. It sounds like those are separate issues.
Yes, they are.
The next one might be pretty quick, which is, at this point, we're not addressing dedicated vacation rentals in the proposal. That's for later. So although the subject
That's
came
correct.
Up in the hearing, we haven't the staff has not modified the,
that's correct,
the proposed code change to deal with that now. We may very well take that up later.
Right. So that was on item number 7. Can we go back to item number 6?
Oh, yeah,
sorry. Yeah. So, and just the primary residence, I don't think we necessarily, and we have talked about what permanent residency means versus primary residence, and we can, you know, stipulate, I think the council needs to say what their intent is, and we can figure out how to codify that, basically. And it doesn't have to be necessarily in alignment perfectly with the tax, city tax code or a state tax code. So item number 6, the host on site. This was another issue that came up during this conversation. And the PSC's recommendation is to not require that the operator be on site when the rooms are rented. They had a robust conversation about it. They landed on, let's put it in our application materials and make it clear what it means to be a good short-term renter, and that you should have somebody who can act on behalf of the owner, or the owner is readily available. So that was their recommendation. Of course, there's the other extreme of requiring that the operator be on site when the nightly rentals are occurring. That's option number 2. And the third was what Commissioner Novick was mentioning, is you could set a maximum number of nights where the rooms are rented when the operator is not present. So the operator's on vacation for a month, and they can continue operating their short-term rental while they're gone. And you could set that at, you know, 30 days, 20 days, 60 days. So those are some options.
And I believe that third option starts to get at Commissioner Fish's concern about occupancy. That might be a smart look at that issue in terms of what is occupancy and how would we regulate that. It would start with an expectation, I would say.
But also raises Commissioner Fish's question about how on earth could we regulate this. Yeah. So
seems to me, if we're going to go with the designee language, then number 1 becomes at least the consistent approach, which is not to start creating subcategories of what a designee can and can't do, but allow them to greet the person. And by the way, the person who is the occupant may actually have a day job and can't be there at 11 o'clock to welcome the guests because they're performing surgery, or they're a clerk in a store or something. So why wouldn't you allow them to have a designee greet the person?
On enforcement, I mean, again, isn't a lot of our enforcement, a lot of things complaint-based? So if people in the community knew that you weren't supposed to be off-site, you know, 6 months of the year with people running there, they might call and complain.
Yeah, this is one issue that BDS and BPS holistically agreed on. There was no debate here. Number 1 is that we don't require an operator to be on-site or owner.
Okay. So let's move on to item number 8, which was the 3-bedroom threshold issue.
I think this was just a question that was raised during the last hearing, was how did we set the 3-bedroom threshold? There was a testifier who I think was a little confused. He was he wasn't saying that he was renting out 3 bedrooms. He said he had a 3-bedroom house, and he was renting out 2 of the bedrooms. So he thought he would go into the conditional use process. So I just wanted to clarify that first. But we did want to clarify, you know, how did we arrive at the 1- and 2-bedroom versus the 3- to 5-bedroom, and the small versus the large. In our thinking that this was an accessory use to the primary use, we thought the resident would at least be occupying 1 bedroom in the house. So 1 or 2 bedrooms is also equal, a little bit more, not too much. Once they start renting out 4 bedrooms in the house and they're occupying 1 bedrooms, it just tilts it more to more of a full-blown bed and breakfast. So that's why we recommended that threshold.
And that doesn't mean that they can't do it. They can still do it. They just need to get a conditional use. They could become a full, you know, a full bed and breakfast. So it's not saying it's that we can't have that.
Clear definition of what a bedroom is?
Yes.
I mean, yes, having once been in the market for buying a house, I was surprised by the creative use of language in terms of the area I lived it was, yeah, was in, and the bonus rooms.
Code
and this
compliance
and that.
Versus
and,
what realtors say.
But I, in New York City, what some people think of as a closet, it's an extra bedroom. I mean, I just want to make sure we have clear understanding of this.
Well, the codes have changed, and that's why we've linked it back to one of the requirements, just to ensure that bedroom or the building code sleeping room term would be met, it meets the building code at the time of construction. And that's really what we're trying to link it to, that it was originally constructed as a sleeping room at that time.
Yeah. Doesn't there have to be some sort of egress, fire egress from a room?
There are different standards throughout development of the building code. So that's what we're looking for, and that's part of the research that we'll be doing. You know, we generally know when something looks off when we see it. Most bedrooms or sleeping rooms that we're going to be brought into, no question. But there will be some that we might have to go back and do some research to ensure that it met the building code requirements. It's not necessarily exit windows or egress windows. They were just light and ventilation requirements previously. So it's kind of a mixture. It's evolved to what we have today.
But so going forward, Paul, were you saying that it is now a requirement that if you have a sleeping room that you have a fire exit?
I should clarify that the current building codes require an egress. You know, if you're building a new house, like Mike is saying, back in 1920s, 1910s, the regulations may have been different. But now, today's code requires each bedroom to have a means of exiting.
That includes sleeping rooms?
It does, and it mirrors how we deal with existing conditions currently, that, you know, this isn't triggering some sort of upgrade into compliance with current code, but we do want to ensure that it's continuing to meet the code, which it's vested into based on the time of its construction. We aren't forcing an upgrade for non-compliant issues to today's code language.
The consensus on that item. Now here's some more tricky stuff, which is the multi-dwelling issue. So maybe Sandra, talk us through 9 and 10. Let's discuss those.
So the two multi-dwelling issues that we've listed are multi-dwelling structures and multi-dwelling development. We're going to get really technical here. So let's talk about multi-dwelling structures, the apartments and condos issue that arose. The PSC recommendation was to not allow them in multi-dwelling structures. They did not have a big, robust conversation about it. We entered the hearing room with a proposal not to allow them in multi-dwelling structures because of what we had discovered in the building code that would require a change of occupancy from a residential occupancy to a hotel occupancy, in essence. They listened to that and what we had discovered and didn't really hear very much testimony on it, so they passed that recommendation along. Since then, we have requested that the state of Oregon give us their interpretation on that, and they confirmed that BDS has the authority to interpret the building code and BDS's position. I should let Paul and Mike speak about it, is that it would require a change of occupancy. So that's where we are on that. As far as a policy goes, the council could decide to allow it in multi-dwelling structures with this proposal and after hearing the rest of the testimony next week, knowing that what the ramifications would be for the building code.
So you're saying we could allow it but not require the upgrade to a hotel occupancy? Is that an option we have?
No, you could allow it, and it would require upgrade to hotel occupancy. But as far as the zoning code is concerned, the zoning code and the land use would be permitted, so that that obstacle will be.
Looks like Planning Commissioner Smith wants to speak about this issue. So, Chris, come on up, because we'd like to maybe check with you on how we're doing overall here, and then particularly on this issue. But while you're coming up, Commissioner Fritz and I had a chance to review the letter we got from the Building Codes Division, and it was somewhat ambiguous. So I'm not sure if we want to seek additional clarification or not.
Well, as Sandra said, Chris Smith, member of the Planning and Sustainability Commission. Sandra has very neatly outlined the question of building use type, and I think prepared for a very defensible finding on why there's a nexus for that policy decision. I think the PSC has another concern, even though we didn't debate this in great detail. It's reflected in Chair Baugh's vote of conscience against even the original PSC recommendation, which is about housing affordability. He had a concern that even in single-family housing, this use may drive out other uses and increase rental prices. At least speaking for myself, and I suspect other members of the commission, we would have a grave concern that if we move into multifamily buildings, that we're going to reduce the supply of housing and, as a consequence, make the remaining housing less affordable is essentially we're now looking at what become whole unit rentals that are displacing a primary occupant as opposed to just somebody with a spare bedroom. Even the spare bedroom case, as we know, Portland has a shortage of family-friendly multi-dwelling rentals, so that, you know, the more than two-bedroom rental supply is relatively limited, and if we're basically encourage that somebody to, you know, have an apartment, use one bedroom, and rent out the other short term, we potentially reduce even more family-friendly rentals. So I want to make sure that as you discuss it, you not just worry about the legalities of the building.